Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and it's a strange thing to be sitting across from Caroline Baum, who has been Booktopia's editorial director for so long and has interviewed so many authors who have come into Booktopia and interviewed them so well, and even interviewed me at one point very well. And to be sitting across from her and having to interview her, and who can judge my interview as she goes along and give me ticks or crosses as she goes along. A little bit daunting, but I welcome Caroline to the Booktopia podcast.
John, it's as weird for me as it is for you. First of all, I'm sitting in the wrong chair as far as I'm concerned. I'm sitting in the author chair and I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing on this side of the microphone? And yeah, if you think it's strange for you, it's pretty strange for me too.
Now, we've come into this podcast because you've written a book called Only, which is got a subtitle, a singular memoir. So memoir of your life, but it starts off with the idea of being an only child.
Yeah, I think that for me, what's happening with memoir as a genre is that people used to write a linear chronological life story and let the events in the story create the drama and momentum. But more recently, many of the memoirs that I have loved have had a theme. So, for example, I'm thinking of Sian Pryor's Shy. When I saw that book, I was quite envious for a moment because I thought, damn, she's got a really good organizing principle there that is really original. And so that helped me think about how to shape a story, which, of course, there's plenty of drama in my story. I'm not saying there isn't. And there is a natural arc to it. But I wanted a way in that would allow me to interpret everything in my life through a particular lens. And there's no doubt that being an only child, I mean, obviously I have no idea what it would be like to have had siblings, but there are lots of things about only children that are preconceptions and notions that I wanted to perhaps challenge a little bit, and also things that I wanted to explore a little bit more that I haven't seen explored in other memoirs. So, for example, when you're an only child, one of the things nobody ever talks about is what it's like to be an only child as an adult who is then singly and solely responsible for two parents. And that's a big part of my story.
That's the flip side, because I was actually not expecting that part, and it really hit me. Telling the idea then is that when we do think of only children, we think of that child being looked after by the parents and all the wonderful things they get and all the attention they get, and I'm one of five kids, so I'm very jealous of all that attention and the stuff. But I never really considered on the other end, and as a child of one of five, there are lots of people who are going to be around to assist with our parents when the time comes. With you, it's just you.
Absolutely, John. And you know, I mean, people talk about the loneliness of only children as children, and there is no doubt that I was lonely as a child, particularly during those endless summer holidays when you'd sort of run out of friends to play with because they would go overseas on holiday or whatever. But the loneliness that I experienced as an only child does not compare with the loneliness that I felt as an only adult when suddenly the shit hit the fan and one of my parents became extremely, extremely ill, and I had to fly back across the world to where my parents lived, still in London, and become the sole mediator, negotiator, carer and advocate for one parent who was in hospital extremely ill and the other who just completely fell apart. Yep. And it's funny what you call on in those situations. Obviously you do call on your husband, in my case, your closest friends, but I do remember sobbing down the phone at one stage to my husband, who was still in Australia arranging to come and join me, and saying, I don't know what to do, and I keep thinking, what would CJ do now? And I was summoning up CJ Craig from the West Wing, because I always thought of her as such a super competent woman that I took my cue from her in lots of ways. You know, when I had to sort of make a big decision professionally, I would think of CJ. And now, because I didn't have brothers or sisters, I was thinking, I need CJ.
Well, I can tell you from my end, there'd be very, even with the five kids, there'd be this kind of isolated sense of who do we turn to? And I think all of us would be looking at each other for the CJ moment, and all of us were hoping that we had a sibling called CJ, because we'd all be just as messed up as the rest of us.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I have been reading a bit about only children, and one of the statistics that I thought was interesting, again, about the sort of, you know, the older only child, is that 80% of only children do not put their parents into care. So the only child accepts responsibility as a given for their parents at the get-go, whereas what I often see in families with siblings is the kind of Goneril and Regan scenario in King Lear of, you have him, no, you have him, no, it's your turn, and I had him over Christmas, so you have him for Easter. So there is a sense that with siblings, it's often very difficult to reach consensus about what is appropriate care and responsibility and filial obligation, and there is a lot of argy-bargy and bartering.
So we have discussed a little bit of the theme of being an only child, but there's that sense of loneliness and isolation is almost a theme of the three people in the relationship, because both parents have extraordinary backstories that come into this book, which must have been very difficult for you to actually stare squarely at, because I can't imagine they're going to be that open with this information, and you'd have to be asking pretty awkward questions to uncover, you know, just what they were feeling, and trying to pick up bits and pieces as you look back over your life at indicators that would give you some idea. And your father was a refugee from the Holocaust. Your mother's story I was just staring at the page, going, "What?"
I know, and I suppose what I think about now is I think about what attracted these two people to each other, and in my mind they were attracted by the sort of iron filings of tragedy that pulled them onto a magnet. And of course, on the surface, they just looked like two young people who were attracted to each other for all sorts of other reasons. My mother was spectacularly beautiful. My mother is spectacularly beautiful, I should say. My father was charismatic and successful and driven, and could also offer her security, which she was very much in need of. Both of them were orphaned. My father was orphaned by history, as you say, and by monumental events. My mother was orphaned by domestic violence through a murder-suicide. And, you know, it took a long time for those two people to realize that they were not suited, and that the real connection between them was a tragic connection. And in terms of finding out the story, the first time I tried to find out about my father's family was when, as a child, given a project at school, you know, about drawing a family tree, I wondered why I didn't have grandparents. And of course, to see an innocent question like that unleash a torrent of tears in an adult who is your father, who you've looked on all your life up until that point as an authoritarian figure of great strength, is terrifying, because you don't know why your question is making this person dissolve in front of you. My mother gave me little sort of snippets of information in a very offhand way. She never really wanted to go into the story. And of course, now that my father isn't here anymore, I really regret that I didn't pay more attention to the things he did tell me. But what I do have, which is an incredibly important resource for me and also a very cherished thing, is he wrote me hundreds and hundreds of letters, and I have them in a great big box by my desk, and if there were a bushfire, I would definitely pick that box and run out with it. Of course, I'd run out with the computer, which has photographs and everything else, but that box is one of my most cherished possessions. And in amongst some of those letters, he did tell me some fragments of family story.
Well, both your parents come across as extraordinarily interesting and rich people. Your mother, after sort of doing the looking after you as a child, and then you going off and doing your own thing, suddenly had this second life with all these Russian refugees coming into the house.
These were dissidents, in fact. They were properly political dissidents in the period before Glasnost, so in the last 10 or 15 years of the Soviet regime, when it was on pretty shaky ground and being led by some very, very old men, there was a flush of fairly significant high-profile intellectual and cultural defectors. And my mother unwittingly had taken her Russian teacher into our home and adopted him virtually. And we'd all accepted that and thought, right, okay, fine, whatever. But we didn't realise that this man that she'd brought into the house as a tenant, Vitya, was connected to a network, like a pipeline, directly back to Moscow and St. Petersburg, of these very distinguished figures who, when they arrived on a cultural tour in London, would come to dinner, and often at the end of dinner they'd say, right, well, that's it, I'm staying now, I'm seeking asylum here. And, you know, they'd still be there 6 months later, and you'd think, when are these people going?
This was one of those moments where, in the book, when I went, has Caroline just taken up Richard Glover's challenge of having the weirdest family? Because he talks about writing his book, and he's like, he talks about the dinner parties he has, and he asks the question, who has the weirdest family? And they all have to tell a story to outbid each other. And I'm thinking, you sat there quietly going, I have the weirdest family. I am coming out with this. The surprising changes that happen in the life of that group of three.
Well, I'm not sure that I can match a parent who has conversations with stuffed toys, specifically teddy bears. So, look, I don't think this is a competition. I don't think memoir is a competition sport. But there is no doubt that for me as an only child, coming home from university during the holidays and doing what everybody does, I think, when they get to their parents' home, which is opening the fridge to see generally what's in there that you can raid and pick at. When I saw that the contents of my parents' fridge had basically shifted from their own European sort of store of pâtés and sausages and things that they like, given that my mother is Parisian and my father was from Vienna, everything suddenly in that fridge was borscht and cabbage and herring and pickles. And I couldn't find anything I wanted to eat. And I just thought, what is going on here? And the first notion that I had that the Russians had invaded, literally invaded the house, was through the fridge.
That's another point in this book. There's a part in one of Christina Stead's books, House of All Nations, where one of the characters visits the home of two wealthy Jewish married couple, and they have drawers and drawers of fine things, and they're all put in perfect little spots, and it's very, very rich, and very, very, I mean, they weren't, you wouldn't have picked them out as rich people, but they had style, and they had taste. Mm-hmm. Reading this book, I felt that I was coming close to seeing a sort of more modern version of this, where this hangover from pre-war Europe, where the childhoods of both your parents and their experiences dragged on, and still dragged, you know, and they like their things to be nice and fine, and they have standards about every aspect of their lives, and they take pleasure in the finer things, not in the sense of look at me, I'm wearing finer things, but actually in the thing itself. And
well, actually, both. I mean, you know, when you say, look at me, I'm wearing finer things, my father was a dandy. I mean, let's face it, he had 122 Hermès silk ties, and he didn't think anyone in London was capable of cleaning them, so he took them back to Paris to be
that
cleaned.
That sort of thing, that's what I'm talking about.
That kind of thing. He wasn't just a dandy for himself, he really cared about the clothes that my mother and I wore, to the extent that when she went in France to a particular maison de couture to have her clothes made, as befitted a sort of the wife of a businessman, my father would get down on the floor with the pin cushion, take it from the vendeuse who was working on the hem of my mother's dresses, and he would fix the hem himself, because he liked to decide and determine for himself how short or how long my mother's dresses would be and how much leg she would or wouldn't show. And equally, when I wanted to buy clothes, the whole family, all three of us, had to go along for my first pair of jeans. I remember just being mortified in the shop by the fact that my father insisted on me twirling so that he could consider me from every angle. I mean, like, you know, there was no privacy. Mm. It was an absolute hothouse of attention. I know, you know, if you've got lots of siblings, if you come from a large family, you might crave some attention, but the attention was so stifling that you could never get away from it. But yes, you're absolutely right. They were sophisticated, but they were also quite acquisitive. So I think that because they'd had very deprived childhoods, they were obsessed with the material security of having things, and not just having them, but having them in bulk. So the pantry was stocked with food that could last through a famine, should it occur. Clothes were bought in multiple quantities. So if my father liked a pair of shoes, he would buy them in sixes, for example. So he'd have them in black, brown, blue, like, you know, every colour they came available in. So yes, the material world in my book is very important.
And that, as an Australian, I felt like I'd been living in some sort of faded white existence until I read this, and this kind of obsession. I mean, I have been to Europe, and I understand that there are very different approaches, and my time in Italy gave me that sense of how rich things could be, and I did feel then the paucity of our home with everything being so so bare.
And the thing is, when you're growing up with it, you don't think that your childhood is privileged. You just take it completely for granted. So I didn't really notice the fact that there were books in every room. I didn't notice the fact necessarily that we listened to music all the time, and that I was taken to concerts. And in fact, I was taken at a ludicrously early age to the opera. I think I was about 12 when I was first taken to hear a Wagner opera, which for me was an absolute torment. But you know, my parents took me to cultural occasions and experiences to amplify my education at school, and our existence was very bookish, and we discussed the news in great detail every day, and we had robust intellectual conversations about world affairs, and I was expected to know about history and significant dates, and sometimes I misinterpreted the information around me. So, for example, my parents were great, great fans of JFK, and the assassination of JFK was the first great tragedy that I witnessed, aged 5, in my parents' lives. And again, you know, was an occasion when I first saw them cry, and I put 2 and 2 together and got 6, and in my over-fertile imagination, I came up with the loopiest scenario about us and JFK that still baffles me to this day.
with this upbringing, this richness coming from all different directions, you head off in this book and start to work as a researcher for Parkinson and Melvin Bragg, and you get to meet these interesting people. And I know from my experience of your time here at Booktopia that you met wonderful writers, and for us watching you do the interviews, sometimes you've met these writers over the course of 20 years, and you have this rich experience, and those interviews are always fed in with all these different experiences you've had in your life. And this book, as I said in my review, it suddenly made sense. So much of your behaviour and who you are started to make sense, and the Caroline Baum that I thought I knew,
phew, thank God for that.
Yes, started to shift, and there was another Caroline Baum that sort of took it. Are you prepared for sharing all this with an audience? Because it reads beautifully, and I soon forgot that I was reading the Caroline Baum that I knew, and I was just reading a wonderfully written book, and I was very pleased to be able to experience that, because whenever you're reading a book of a person you know, it can get awkward, but you give me the opportunity to just come out with praise, which is great.
Thank God for that. Look, that's a really long and quite complicated question there, John. Let me unpack it a bit. I think, look, this is the first interview that I'm doing about the book, and I do feel suddenly, crikey, it's like people are going to be able to see me in X-ray. And the weird thing is that when you're writing the book, you don't think about who's going to be reading it. You don't think about the people you know who are going to be reading it, and you don't think about the ones who you don't know. I guess there's a kind of disconnect that you do, because if you did think about all of those people, it would spook you and inhibit you, and you wouldn't be able to be honest and open and truthful, and I wanted to be as truthful as I could be. I think that one of the great legacies of that experience of working for Michael Parkinson and then working for Melvyn Bragg, I think I say in the book that my first interview as an absolute rookie on the team with Michael Parkinson was being sent to interview the great Hollywood Hellraiser actor Lee Marvin. And then the second interview was with Ingrid Bergman, who had, you know, practically saintly status as an actor at the time. And the great thing was that it taught you not to be afraid of those people. You just had to dive in, you had to meet them quickly, you had to form a rapport, you had to earn their trust and get on with eliciting the information. And so I think that that was brilliant training for the extraordinarily famous people who rocked up in the house as Russian defectors. You know, I wasn't sort of totally starstruck and speechless when those people were there. And equally in my professional life interviewing writers, I am able to remember that everybody is human and vulnerable. And so I think that that's a great help in building a quick rapport, because let's face it, most of the time when you're interviewing a writer, you've got 10 minutes backstage to kind of make them feel comfortable with you. And so you need shortcuts, you need strategies, you need skills. And so I think that I learned those back with Michael and Melvyn, Melvyn, interestingly, of course, is an only child, another only child. And I didn't really think about that too much at the time that I was working with him, but it did dawn on me later that there were some interesting indicators there.
Caroline Baum, thank you very much for coming in and speaking to us about your memoir, Only. I said in my review that it was an extraordinary book and a very interesting read in so many different levels. And I thank you for writing and putting it, all this down. It's a marvellous achievement.
Well, thank you very much, John, for having me here at Booktopia. It's very nice to come home.
Caroline Baum's book, Only, is available at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.